Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Very good. Is there a motion to approve the minutes for September 26, 2018?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
Is this mic on? Is it on? I can't hear. Thank you.
You sound good. Anybody from the public want to talk? Okay. Public Health in Action. Love that title.
Good morning, counselors. For the record, Dr. Alan Milne, Public Health Director and Health Officer. Since we have a cradle-to-grave service here in public health, we're going to talk about vital records, death certificates, child death review. I've got Kathy Ramage, who's our vital records clerk, and David Hudson, who's our program manager for our Healthy Communities program. Kathy's going to talk about death certificates, and then David's going to talk about child death review.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm going to talk about birth and death certificates and what we do in our office. Again, my name is Kathy Ramage. I'm a deputy register for Clark County Vital Records. I work at the front counter processing birth and death certificates for clients who walk into our office, and at times orders that are submitted by email or by vital check. The reasons you may need a birth certificate would be for a passport, a child entering kindergarten, or wanting to play sports. Other times we get to help register the birth of a child who was born at home. Then there are times you may need a death certificate, and we can assist with that as well. We hear many stories every day in the work and that we do, and I am proud to help the people in our community. Some other ways that I feel we help people are, once in a while people come in who were adopted looking for their birth family. As of November 2014, those birth records were unsealed in the state of Washington, and we were able to help them navigate the state process. Sometimes fathers' names are left off the birth certificate. We assist the parents in completing the application to get the father's name on the certificate. Other times, the information on a person's original birth record may be incorrect, and we can help them get that corrected with direction on what kind of documents they need to submit. Occasionally, we pull up records, birth records that are flagged by the state per law enforcement regarding missing children or child abduction. Mm. There are times we assist families in the midst of grief by helping them navigate through the process of obtaining a death certificate for important legal matters. We also work with the funeral home, medical examiner, and physician to assure the death certificate information is correct. In 2017, there were 5,747 birth certificates issued. There were 2,267 deaths in Clark County and 7,904 death certificates issued. In 2018, as of 10/17, there were 10,430 birth certificates issued. There were 2,864 deaths in Clark County and 13,440 death certificates issued. Not only does vital records help individuals, but death and birth information contributes to population of data, which helps communities gauge various public health indicators. For example, we are working with Healthy Communities to support their child death review. And at this time, I will turn this over to David.
I have a question for death certificates. So you have a death certificate, and then you have a certified or death certificate that's certified. That's what the insurance, isn't there?
So when a person passes away,
right,
they get a certified death certificate.
And you can get copies.
An original document each
of the original
time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But the certified, I think there's more money than a...
They're all certified documents.
Oh, they're all certified.
Any
now.
Other kind.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair,
The numbers that you gave, I didn't quite understand the difference in the numbers of the deaths. You gave, I guess, a total, and then the other smaller number, was that child?
Well, the smaller number was the total death, and the other number was the total certificates. So a family may come in.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's okay. People requested. I got you. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
You're welcome.
And how long does it take from a death to a certificate?
Depending on how long it takes the doctor to sign the document.
Oh, okay. So that's what you get is from the doctor.
Yeah, sometimes it gets hung up there.
Right.
And now it's all electronic, so the funeral home will start it.
Oh,
and then
okay.
The doctor needs to go in and put their cause of death information in and sign off on it. And then the funeral home reviews it, and then we go in and review and make sure all the boxes are checked. And
okay.
Sometimes the physicians occasionally don't fill in or sign the death certificate, and sometimes I have to go on electronically and do it as well.
Oh, do you? Okay. Oh, interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Morning.
Good morning. So, again, I'm David Hudson, and I'm here to talk about child death review. Another uplifting topic this morning. And Child Death Review is a national program that looks at all unnatural deaths of children up to age 19. So this could include events such as suicide, suffocation, choking, drownings, fire-related deaths, motor vehicle accidents. And all 50 states do child death review, and there's about 6 to 8 counties in Washington state that do it on a regular basis. And we will bring together, so there's about 6 to 8 counties that are doing child death review. Clark County actually did this in the past about 10 years ago, and then we lost state funding to support this work. So we want to bring it back, and our focus is really on prevention. And there was an interest in the community, especially around suicides from the schools, to do child death review so we can review the issues around different types of deaths in Clark County and really with a focus on prevention. So prevention in terms of these events occurring, what we can do to prevent these deaths occurring in the future, but also for households where a child death occurred, if there's other children in that household, how we can prevent those children from being at risk based on the issues of the deaths. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the data we have around child deaths. Again, this is unnatural children's deaths up to age 19. And then I'm going to talk about who's involved, because there's a team of experts that we're bringing together. So this infographic shows that about the larger box indicates that there's more deaths for these particular issues. So in 2017, about one-third of unnatural deaths of children were suicide-related, and that goes back to my earlier comment, how the schools have really expressed interest in doing child death review here in Clark County. So I'm sure many of you are aware of some of the issues around suicide. And as we look at the data for 2018, it's similar. The majority of cases for the data that we have so far in 2018 show that suicide is the leading cause of death of children. And then, again, motor vehicle accidents, suffocation, drowning, and poisonings are the other next leading cases issues.
Is this under 18?
19. So 19. 18 and 364 days, technically.
And find it odd there's no overdose or anything?
Well, this is just showing the leading causes. There have been some overdose cases, and what we're doing is looking at trend data over the 10 years. I don't have that data in front of me, but there have been some overdose cases.
Oh, okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I see SIDS is there. You don't consider that a natural death?
No. That's considered unnatural.
Hmm.
Would you explain that a little bit? Because we don't exactly know what that is. We don't know how to prevent it.
Right. Well,
I mean, there are ways to lessen the possibility, but... Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it relates to safe sleep, and there's, and we, really, when we look at these issues around unnatural deaths, there's, it's a, as I said, it's a federal program, and we're working closely with the director of the Center for, the National Center for Fatality Review and Prevention, and we really use their guidelines in terms of what are considered natural deaths.
Just to add here, like, this is a really great question because it illustrates the value of doing this. You might remember that the recommendation was to put your baby to sleep prone, and then we developed the back. When we looked at data from SIDS deaths, just, you know, child death review, realized that that's where the back to sleep campaign figured it was unsafe to put children prone. So that's an example of how we use data from child death review to deal with something that's unnatural, figure out one of the causes and reduce it.
But I think my problem with it is this. Parents that lose a child to SIDS always blame themselves. There's one more thing I could have done. I could have checked. I could have. That is just the nature of being human. Sure. So when it, and it's, do we consider it the parent's fault?
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of times it's the messaging and the communication that goes out.
I mean, if it's an unnatural death,
right,
then we get into what is the fault? What went wrong and who was responsible for that to have not happened?
Yeah, but I think...
My point is when we list it as unnatural,
mm-hmm.
The parents who already grieve, who already second-guess themselves, who already have terrible doubt and guilt in many cases. It's as though that could have been managed better, that the parents weren't very good parents. That's not the case.
Right. That's a good point. So one thing I failed to mention is that when we do these reviews, it's totally confidential. So in no way are the parents notified that we're doing these reviews on various cases. They're not at the meetings, and there's no follow-up directly with the parents. Does that make sense? So there's not, the focus is not blame on the parents. We're trying to understand as experts in different fields, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, what we could do to help these families and prevent these deaths in the future.
Can I just add something here? So the term unnatural is, the medical examiner on the death certificate, it says unnatural versus natural causes. So that's a definition that's been used. Regardless of the child death review, the death certificate is going to be labeled, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, it's going to be listed as unnatural. And unnatural, you know, these are unlike, you know, like heart disease or cancer or something like that, these will be listed as unnatural. So it's not the child death review that creates that designation. It's already there. What the child death review is takes these unnatural cases and studies them to learn whether they're, not to blame anybody, whether it's parents or anybody else, but to identify, given that it's unnatural, identify risk factors, kind of like what we did with the SIDS deaths, which are labeled as unnatural, identify risk factors to prevent them from happening in the future. And David's going to talk a little bit more about it. It goes into a big national database so we can mine the data and learn something from it.
Sure. And the loss of a child under any circumstances is such a sensitive matter and so traumatic. I don't want parents to misunderstand the information that we're talking about.
Sure.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, not to belabor this, but is a heart attack unnatural? Or is it a natural death?
That's natural.
Natural.
Yeah.
And SIDS, the actual name is Sudden Infant Death Syndrome. It sort of seems to mean that they're is a syndrome that happens. Therefore, that should be more natural. But anyway, we can't really argue with you because you don't create this. It seems unnatural.
Right. Right.
For this to be on the list.
Yeah. Okay. Point well taken. So the other point I make on this topic is that we could, as a committee, we could decide to look at review all unnatural deaths for a particular time period, or we could choose to focus in on certain issues, such as suicide. So we're not going to decide that as Clark County Public Health. We're going to reach out to our partners that are part of this child death review team and ask them what they would prefer. And we do know, like I said earlier, that there is a lot of issue around better understanding the suicides that have occurred across Clark County.
Although, to your point there, I was on the state's death review for 2 or 3 years, and really it's because of that, the crib deaths is why there is a different way of making cribs now. It's because of them.
Mm-hmm.
Investigations, you know, yeah.
Right. And then in terms of the confidentiality, so we ask partners to bring any information and data or reports that they have that they can share to the meetings. All that is either sent encrypted or they just bring it in paper form. If it is sent electronically, it would be sent encrypted or with password protected. And then at the end of the meetings, none of the information that's shared leaves the room. It's collected. So no one in the committee can leave with any information. And obviously there's some information that cannot be shared. And then all members sign a confidentiality agreement to participate on this review team. And then, as Alan was saying earlier, there is a national database that's housed at the Michigan Public Health Institute, and that's where we enter all of our data into. So we can look at our own data and see trends across time, but we wouldn't obviously have access to any other jurisdiction's data as part of this database. So I've talked a little bit about the team, and this is a list of the team members that we have engaged, and they have agreed to participate on the team. And we have actually a core team, and these people would come to every meeting, which at this point we anticipate would be once a quarter. And then we also have an ad hoc team, and I'll show you that in a minute. And the ad hoc team would come based on the issues that we're going to discuss. So if we decide that we're going to discuss all unnatural deaths and it was fire-related, then we would have our representative from the fire department, Clark County Fire and Rescue, come to the meeting, and then they would be able to share their expertise and bring any data they have related to that particular case. So our next steps are that the director of the National Center for Fatality Review and Prevention and one of her colleagues is coming to Vancouver in December. So we're quite honored because they don't typically work at the local level. They usually work at the state level, but she's agreed to come out because she has a lot of interest in this in Washington State. And she's going to facilitate our first meeting. So there we actually will review a couple cases from 2018, and we're working with her on which cases to choose. And after that, like I said, we plan to meet quarterly with the group. And, you know, I can come back and follow up with you on data that we have once we know more about cases over time, over the 10-year trend, but also more recent cases in 2018.
So do you do all cases in Clark County?
So that's the question for the group to decide. The director from the National Center that I mentioned earlier, her recommendation is that we review all cases, but she said that's really up to the jurisdiction. So we really want to ask the team what they would prefer. Obviously, if we do all cases, it's a longer review, and we might have to meet more frequently. So I think that's...
Well, the question I have, so the state has their own with foster care and other dependent cases. If there's... I don't know if we want if you're going to do them cases, but there should be at least a connection there, an ad hoc member or something. Because if you have a foster kid, they do it all, you know.
So I'm not sure I understand your question.
So if you have a foster child that dies,
right,
they have their own death review. The state does.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, actually. I was on that team.
Okay.
And so they should be somehow in this mm-hmm. mix.
So you can see on this slide that I have, we do have a court-appointed special advocate
right. As
an ad hoc member. So if we do decide to review all cases, then at the state level, they would be able to look at our data and compare it to other jurisdictions in Washington State and, of course, the state as a whole. But again, I don't know which cases we're going to end up reviewing, if it's going to be all, if we're going to pick specific issues. Okay.
So the ad hoc committee members, are there on behalf of prevention?
Well, actually, everyone is on behalf of prevention. So when we review a case, at the end, once we get all the data that we have available and we enter that, then we discuss preventative measures that we can take. So everybody that attends the meetings will be involved in the discussion around prevention. The ad hoc members just mean that if we had a case that involved domestic violence or fire-related, they would come. If we don't, then they wouldn't attend those meetings. Does that make sense?
Sort of. So all foster children do not have a court-appointed special advocate. There's no direct nexus
right.
between those two programs.
Right.
So frequently, so court-appointed advocates can be an advocate for a child in the case of a nasty divorce, for mm-hmm. example, or child custody,
right.
or whatever. So they... But they're not involved in every difficult case.
Right.
So to Mark's point regarding foster children, any of those that have injury or death in a foster situation.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, if we were reviewing a case with a foster child, and there was no court-appointed special advocate, they would not attend that meeting. Does that make sense? Just like if there was not a fire-related death, the fire department wouldn't come to the meeting. These are just ad hoc based on the cases that we review. And in this previous slide that I showed, this is the core team. So these members would come to every meeting.
In the court team, you say police. Is that Children's Justice Center also?
There is someone.
We talked about that, and there was a big, you know, there was a big deal. Is this law enforcement or is this public health? And mm-hmm. it's, you know.
Yes, one of the members is from the Children's Justice Center, but. For the police, we have a representative from the Vancouver Police that's agreed to come to the meeting. Now,
one of the members is from the Children's Justice Center.
Yes.
And that's a good tag to the state.
Okay.
You got that. You would have that covered.
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Was that it? Thank you. Yeah.
We'll bring back more information to you. Team come back and fill you in on how that's going. No other questions about it.
Okay. Director's report.
So I've been here for, 12 years now, and I think this is the first time since I've been here, that we've dealt with algae blooms as this late in the year. So last week we had an algae bloom at Round Lake, and as well as the following day, we were able to identify an algae bloom at Lacamas Lake. So we posted the lakes. So algae can elaborate some toxins. The biologic name for blue-green algae is cyanobacteria, and they can produce some toxins that can be harmful to both people as well as animals, and both toxic to the liver as well as to the nervous system.
What was the posting?
When?
Was the posting for swimming, or I know Round Lake.
Yeah, so the...
They canoe, don't they, a lot?
Yeah, you can canoe. So the deal is you shouldn't, neither you nor your pets should have contact with the water. So the signs are posted basically saying, there's different levels of signs that we generally post depending on what the lab results are, but the signs basically say, you know, there's a bloom present, there may be toxins in the water, no wading, no swimming, keep your pets out of the water.
Don't fall in.
Don't. You know, I was looking at my records. I think back in 2009, somebody's dog actually died. I think it was at Lacamas Lake, and there was a bloom present. So, yeah. So, and I remember a few years ago, there was a bloom on Vancouver Lake, and there was some dragon boat races. But as long as people weren't really getting into the water, but basically the deal is no contact with the water because it can be toxic. You can't, just because there's a bloom present doesn't mean there are toxins in the water. The cyanobacteria can elaborate these toxins at any time, and one day you might not have them in the water and the next day you will. We tested the water last week, and Lacamas Lake did test positive for microcystin, which is one of the toxins. One of our staff went out again the lake was posted. One of our staff went out on Monday. The bloom was still present. We got some additional samples. And we don't have the results. It took a few days to get the results, but the lake is still posted. I'm hoping with the weather change and the rain. So cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, need nutrients, organic material in the water, as well as sunshine. And I'm hoping with the change in the weather and the sunshine going away, the bloom will go away. So that's where we're at right now. So the lakes are still posted.
That'll probably be a more persistent, or we'll have to look at that more often, because the 2007 comp plan, when it said that Ledbetter Road would go away, and then the main road would go around the other side of the hill, and Ledbetter would become a trail. That's going to be an extremely popular trail when that happens.
Well, as long as people stay on the trail and don't jump into the algae bloom, we're probably okay.
It's the fun of it.
Mr. Chair, I have a separate question. In the Columbian on, I think it was last Thursday or Friday, there was an article about a fish die-off in both, I think it was Round Lake, and for sure it was Vancouver Lake. Did you review that? Does public health review that? Not the fish and wildlife side of it, but the possible interaction with humans and a large fish diet.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I reviewed, you know, I saw the information from Fish and Wildlife, and that fish die-off was related to, it wasn't related to things like cyanobacteria or toxins and like, it was related to low level of oxygen in the lake, and it has to do with you know, climactic conditions as well as the amount of nutrients in the lake. Not a danger to humans. I mean, when the oxygen level goes down in the water, fish can't breathe, and there's a die-off. And these fish, apparently, I think they were shad. They're not native to the areas. They're not well adapted to the conditions here. So there wasn't really a risk. I mean, other than the aesthetic thing of seeing a bunch of dead fish, there really wasn't a risk to the public from that fish diet.
It occurred to me that a bunch of rotting dead fish might not make for a good swimming area, but there's not a specific danger to human interaction.
Correct, other than getting, you know, being sickened by the rotting smell or whatever. But in terms of an effect on human health,
which itself is a deterrent.
I think that would probably keep people out. I mean, I don't know exactly how many fish were there, but if there were a large number of them and they were rotting, it wouldn't be a very pleasant experience. But in terms of the risk to the public, no, I mean, as long as we don't have gills, you know, we need to breathe, you know, we're not, yeah, it's the risk to the fish and not us, thankfully. It is unpleasant, though.
I did visit Vancouver Lake on Friday afternoon.
And what did you?
I saw a couple hundred people there.
Were there any dead fish? Or
nobody was mentioning dead fish. Okay. There was a marathon that was staged out of there, and it was a great day, and people were having a great time at the park. So,
yeah, and no risk to the public from this. Otherwise, we would have posted. We would have been concerned. But
great, thanks.
Very good.
Any other questions about?
Not about that, but I do. If you don't get to it, I'll be asking the question. But go ahead.
Okay. The next thing is influenza. So we've already started our surveillance system. And I'm not going to show you the graph today because the levels are too low. But we're going to be bringing this back to you regularly in the director's report. So we know that flu season has started when more than 10% of the lab results that doctors get, you know, when they're getting sample specimens from patients, when more than 10% test positive, then we're in the flu season. We're not there yet. And actually, last week it was 0% positivity. So we're not even close. But we're monitoring this, and I can't predict when the flu season is going to begin. But since this is a public meeting, I want to urge the public again to get the flu shot. If they haven't had it yet, get it now, because it can take up to 2 weeks to build immunity. And it's still the best thing you can do to prevent the flu. And we don't know exactly when the flu season is going to start. One of the reasons we monitor this so closely is we share our surveillance data with our healthcare partners. So they're prepared, and they use the data to, for example, if, you know, one of the healthcare facilities decide they want to have a masking policy, they use this data to inform them when the flu season has begun.
Great coverage. Good job.
Just to reemphasize that, I saw on the news yesterday the first flu death in the state of Washington occurred earlier this week. So
it's going to be here. Yeah. And yeah. So there's tens of thousands of deaths every year in the United States from influenza.
I'm
all set.
Okay. So I also read a report about Chief Umchuck Elementary School, and was it a chicken pox outbreak?
You're talking about Daybreak Primary School?
Is it Daybreak, maybe?
Yeah, Daybreak Primary School in Battleground. So there's a chicken pox outbreak. So an outbreak is defined when you have five or more cases at the school. And what concerned us about this school is that there's a large number of children at that school who have exemptions. So there's a large number of unimmunized kids. I think once we ask folks for, and this is off the top of my head, but folks here can correct me if I'm wrong, but once we ask people for documentation of immunity for their kids, I think we identified about 38 kids who are unimmunized and susceptible, which is concerning for us. So we actually issued a requirement for the school. We met with the deputy superintendent, the superintendent's office, school nurse, and we issued a requirement for exclusion from school for staff and students who are susceptible, unimmunized. If they got the shot, they can go back the following day, so they didn't have to be out for the full 21 days, but exclusion orders for 21 days, they can go back if they got the shot. One of the concerns around chickenpox is, and there's a lot of information, misinformation out there, we all think of it, maybe it's the name chickenpox, and we all think of it as this benign condition. And actually, for most people, it's a pretty mild illness, but there are complications. You can get, for example, pneumonia. Pregnant women who get chickenpox are more at risk for pneumonia. I'm not sure exactly why, but they are. That's the data. So there are some nasty complications with it. We take it seriously. And given the large number of susceptibles and the long incubation period, if you don't kind of nip this in the bud right away, you can have these cases going on, dribbling in for several months at a time, and it becomes pretty disruptive for the school as well. So given the large number of kids that were unimmunized and given the concerns about the potential side effects, and the school agreed, we issued this exclusion requirement.
And you said that includes staff, too?
Includes staff, too.
Interesting that a shot would take such immediate effect, that an immunization.
No, so the shot doesn't take immediate effect. So the reason we're doing so if you get the shot soon enough after exposure, it will protect you.
Oh, okay.
But you have to get it soon enough. We're not. Some of these shots will not be given soon enough after exposure, but the reason for it is we're looking for long-term immunity as well.
Right.
Because the transmission can keep on going on. So if we get all the kids immunized now, 3 months from now, we're not going to be dealing with new cases popping up. Okay. So that's the reason for doing that.
Okay. So if you're an adult, should you get the shot?
Yes, adults can get the – so adults born after 1980 who don't have documented – history of chickenpox disease or haven't had the shot, yes, they can get a shot.
That's probably not you, Mark.
Probably not.
You, being as young as you are, you know, you're.
But I've had chickenpox.
Me too. That was about, thanks for asking the question. That's about, that's all I had for you today.
Okay.
And we might give you a summary about this at an upcoming Board of Health meeting at a public health in action piece.
Very good.
Okay.
Hey, thank you, everybody. Meeting adjourned.